We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Senate Democrats failed to pass a bill expanding abortion rights, losing West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin along the way in what they call a messaging vote. What kind of message did they end up sending? Plus, Finland decides to join NATO, while Sweden may do the same soon, perhaps this weekend. What are the implications for the defense alliance and U.S. interests of this expansion? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot. I'm here with my colleagues Kim Strassel and Kyle Peterson for another edition of Potomac Watch. Thanks so much for joining us. So let's start with the abortion vote in the Senate, which Chuck Schumer, of course, in the majority, decided as majority leader to bring this up, even though he and his fellow Democrats knew that this would be filibustered by Republicans, therefore not become law. But they wanted to send a message, as they put it, wanted to get Republicans on record. But in the process, they lost one Democrat, Joe Manchin, and that means they didn't even have a majority for the vote. But let's listen to Kamala Harris, the vice president, on the vote.
The Senate failed to stand in defense of a woman's right to make decisions about her own body. And let's be clear, the majority of the American people believe in defending a woman's right, her choice, to decide what happens to her own body. And this vote clearly suggests that the Senate is not where the majority of Americans are on this issue.
Kim, so they knew it was going to fail. Why would Democrats bring up a vote they knew was going to fail?
Well, as you said, this was meant to be a messaging vote. I think there's a couple of problems with it, though, strategically. One is that, as you know, the message was that they don't have a majority in the Senate to overturn anything. But also, the weirdness of some of these messaging votes these days is they just don't work as well. Most Republicans, if you went and asked them about the vote this week, they'd say they were thrilled to have taken it because they hail from red states and a lot of their population is in the same place they are, which, by the way, is far more complicated than Kamala Harris stated it to be. It isn't necessarily about a question of a woman's right to choose, but rather who gets to decide that if it's done at a state level or whether or not it's imposed by judicial fiat. But a Senate that is increasingly one in which most Republicans there come from red states and most Democrats there come from blue states, which is a big switch from even a decade ago when you had a lot more kind of cross-party representation of these different places, it's much harder to actually put forward a vote that is politically sensitive or hurtful to the other side. Chuck Schumer decided to try it anyway, but I doubt he got much out of it.
Kim, I guess they're hoping that this vote will work against Republican candidates or sitting senators in states like Arizona, New Hampshire, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Nevada, where they are going to have difficult competitive Senate races. The Democrats in New Hampshire, Nevada, Arizona in particular seem to be delighted with this vote because it's going to motivate, they think, more Democratic voters to come out. And then they hope maybe they can whipsaw Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, running for re-election there as well with driving Democratic turnout.
Yeah, that's their bet. They don't have anything else. Look, they don't want to be running on the economy. They don't want to be running on inflation. They don't want to talk about some of the other economic turmoil, the stock market, the border, what's going on elsewhere. So this is what they're going to glom onto. The question, though, and I think it's a legitimate one, is we don't really know yet how this is going to play. And they're placing a lot of eggs in the abortion basket when, if you look out there, a lot of the polls and a lot of the reporting done just in the week since this Supreme Court leak came out suggests that a lot of voters, in fact, most voters, are far more concerned with those other issues, for instance, inflation. And it's, I think, a legitimate question, which a number of House centrist candidates are now asking on the Democratic side, of whether or not they should, in fact, be putting more of their efforts into passing passing some kitchen table bills that look as though they're doing something about these problems rather than leaning so heavily on a cultural issue like abortion.
Part of the complication for the politics here is, as often the case, the substance. The proponents of the bill in the Senate said, oh, this is merely the codification of Roe v. Wade. But let's listen to Joe Manchin talk about that.
I was hopeful that the Democratic Party, having control of the agenda, would put a piece of legislation forward that would codify Roe v. Wade. 70% of the American public wants Roe v. Wade to be codified, as has been precedented law for 50 years. To me, that would be the reasonable, rational thing to do. The bill we have today to vote on, the Women's Health Protection Act, and I respect people who support, but don't make no mistake, it is not Roe v. Wade codification. It's an expansion. It wipes 500 state laws off the books. It expands abortion. And with that, that's not where we are today. We should not be dividing this country further than we're already divided. And it's really the politics of Congress that's dividing the country. It's not the people.
Kyle, you've dug into the details of the Senate bill and what Joe Manchin was talking about. Why don't you elaborate on that with some specifics?
Sure. Well, I would name two. One is that this bill, the Women's Health Protection Act, would protect the right to abortion after viability if the healthcare provider says that it is vital for the patient's health. And the question is, what does health mean? What does the word health mean in this context? And opponents of the bill say that in other places, for example, some European countries, they have similar provisions, but they don't really act as a deterrent because those requests, those health exceptions, are generally granted if they are asked for. And so opponents of the bill say that that would basically mean that anybody could get an abortion at any time up to basically through 9 months if you can make some sort of argument that it is for your health, your mental health, your emotional health, and so on. The second is a piece we've talked about a little bit, and that's parental notification laws. And this is why, again, I think the politics of this are pretty unclear, but it's potential that it cuts both ways. And I would point to a quote given to a National Review reporter by Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, who's in a swing state there. And he says, ultimately, I feel that young women at a certain age should have the rights to make these kind of decisions with their doctor. I'm not going to be the arbiter of an age and a timeline, unquote. And so it is not hard to imagine a campaign ad in October saying that Mark Kelly voted to overturn parental notification laws. And if your 16-year-old daughter, you know, needs to get an abortion, that Arizona's law that requires them to talk to you about it and get your consent, that that would be overthrown here. And it's not clear to me that that's an obvious winner for the Democratic Party. And one final thing I would add on the politics is, and to the point Joe Manchin is making, is that two Republican senators, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, have proposed their own bill that would more narrowly codify Roe v. Wade. And Chuck Schumer was asked whether he would bring that bill up for a vote. And he said, we are not looking to compromise on something as vital as this. And I think that is fascinating because he could have probably gotten in the Senate a 52-48 vote at least in favor of codifying Roe v. Wade. It would have failed the filibuster, but you probably would have gotten Joe Manchin. You would have gotten at least these two senators on board, but you would have given some cover to these Republicans and you would have upset some Democrats on your left flank. And he thought that that trade-off was not worth it.
Yeah, that's the fascinating thing here politically. Why, Kim, why not try to get Collins and Murkowski and Manchin? You can say we have a majority, that the Republicans in the Senate are blocking the will of a majority. And instead, they went with the more radical bill. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that Planned Parenthood and many of the Democratic base really do want expansive abortion rights right up to the last day of pregnancy. And that's what they're responding to. Now, also on the politics of this, as you know, politics is often a contest of enthusiasm. How much do you want to vote? How eager are you going to vote? To vote? Are you going to sit at home? And Democrats have been very worried this election cycle that Republicans are really fired up, as often happens in a midterm election when you have the party out of power. They want to stick a defeat on the president in power. And so Republicans are fired up and Democrats have been worried that their voters are not. And they're hoping that the abortion issue will drive young people, women, part of their base to the polls. And you can see that in a new Monmouth poll that is coming out saying that more Democrats will vote on the abortion issue than Republicans will, by about 10, 15 percentage points.
Yeah, this is certainly something they should be worried about, because if you look, for instance, at the primaries that we have held so far this year, you've certainly seen that lopsided enthusiasm in that you've had a lot more Republicans coming out to vote than Democrats. So this is, again, one of their lifelines. We will see if it works. I think one of the other goals of it, and you had mentioned Planned Parenthood earlier, is that they're facing a problem too, that a lot of the activist base of their party, and these are the folks that mobilize during elections to register people to vote, to get out the vote, they're disenchanted with the Biden White House. They remain demoralized that the Build Back Better agenda didn't pass and doesn't seem to have a pathway at the moment. They feel as though the president hasn't accomplished nearly as much as he said he would. Even though I find this kind of astonishing, this is the most progressive presidency ever and basically takes marching orders from these people, but they nonetheless feel let down. So this is an opportunity for Schumer and the White House and the House to also try to re-energize these groups and get them out there as the army that they need to mobilize people. Again, we'll see if that lasts. That's the other issue, too. We've got quite a few months yet to go until the midterms with a lot of other big pressing problems hanging out there. Can you maintain a level of outrage and enthusiasm through that period of time over a single issue?
Thank you, Kim. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the politics of the abortion debate inside the Supreme Court, to the extent we know it, and also Finland and Sweden bid to join NATO when we come back.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kyle Peterson and Kim Strassel. And all of the political discussion that we have been having here about abortion will hang on just what the court decides to do on the case of Dobbs from the Mississippi, on the statute that would bar abortions, most abortions, after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Now, the draft opinion that was leaked by Justice Samuel Alito would overturn Roe v. Wade. It has support, we know, of 5 votes. At least it did as of February. And the question becomes, what happens when the final decision comes out? Will the 3 liberals justices seem fixed in opposition and dissent? It's a little less clear where John Roberts, the Chief Justice, comes out. My information, based on my reporting, has been that he is not going to join the majority opinion. At least he wasn't at the conference. They took their initial vote, and that's why Justice Clarence Thomas, the most senior justice, when he's in the majority and the chief is not, he gets to assign the opinion. He assigned it to Justice Alito, and that's how that opinion came out. My information, the latest opinion, Kyle, is that this majority is holding. I guess I'm not surprised, given the leak that came out. It would be awkward, to say the least, for one of the justices to change his mind now and move in the direction of the dissenters or of the chief and come out with a kind of a middle-of-the-ground decision that would uphold the Mississippi ban, but not overturn Roe v. Wade when you were prepared to do so now that we know at an earlier stage. Any thoughts on that kind of maneuvering inside the court?
Well, I do agree with that. And it has been interesting. In recent days, we've gotten some more leaks about the leak and some questions answered. So the initial leak of this Alito draft opinion is, of course, dated February. And one of the questions had been, why is this such an old draft being leaked? Because presumably there would be subsequent drafts. Is there some game that the leaker is playing to, you know, leak the earliest and most rough version of the Alito opinion in order to get some more criticism of it? And then Politico this week has a couple of pieces of news, leaks about the leak again, where it's saying that the draft majority opinion from February overturning Roe remains the court's only circulated draft. That is interesting. And then it's also saying that no dissenting draft opinions have circulated from any justice. And I don't know the details enough about the internal workings to know if the timeline here makes that curious, that in a normal case by now you would have had other dissents circulating. But one thing that you could imagine, doing a little bit of Kremlinology here, is that maybe Chief Justice John Roberts is still in this middle position, still trying to make the case to uphold the Mississippi law without overturning Roe. And maybe some of those dissents are waiting to see what happens, waiting to see if the majority changes, waiting to see other opinions that could come out before they begin their dissenting. On the other hand, it's also possible that those dissents are taking so long simply because the dissenting justices, maybe Sonia Sotomayor, maybe Elena Kagan, are working real hard to make sure that they make the most persuasive case they can. So it is fascinating from the outside to try to figure out what's going on inside the court. And we have a little bit more clarity about the leak, but I still think we don't have a great picture of where things stand at the moment.
Well, we shall find out. Let's turn to the news about NATO and Finland making the decision this week, announcing that it will formally request membership in the Defense Alliance in Europe. And Sweden, its northern European neighbor, expecting to do the same on the weekend. This isn't, Kim, what the Kremlin had in mind when it invaded Ukraine, was strengthening NATO, expanding NATO, you can bet on that. And yet it is, in fact, it's the driving force behind these countries' decisions. Finland has an 830-mile border with Russia, and like Sweden, even during the heights of the Cold War, when tensions were highest and the risks greatest, neither country joined NATO. They preferred to be neutral. Now, both countries do operate with militaries that do have pretty close associations with NATO, but they never formally joined. And it's a sign of how the invasion of Ukraine has backfired on the Kremlin, that these countries now look at Ukraine, which never belonged to NATO, though it had perhaps sought membership in the future, and Georgia, the country in Central Asia that was also looking to join NATO but never did. That was invaded by Russia. Moldova never joined NATO, and that had a part of its territory, Transnistria, carved out with the help of Russia as a breakaway region. Contrast that with the Baltic states and Poland and the other states, which, particularly the Baltic, small states, which have large ethnic Russian populations, but they belong to NATO and they have not been invaded. And I think my own view is that Finland and Sweden, Kim, are looking at this lineup and saying, you know what, NATO is better protection for us if we're inside than outside.
Yeah, and that's a pretty clear lesson to draw. You know, if you go back just even a couple of years ago, support within Finland in particular for joining NATO was only at about 20 to 30% of the population. Recent polls show that it's now soared to more than 70%, which is, by the way, also something that makes it easier for Finnish and Swedish leaders to go this route because they're now working in the will of their people rather than against it. There's been long debates in both countries about how to do this, but popular sentiment was very much against it. And the idea behind it in the past was that Finland and Sweden both claimed they were military non-aligned, and so they walked this very careful balancing act where they tried to both maintain relations with Russia. They also belong to something called the Nordic Defense Cooperation Pact, along with Denmark and Norway and Iceland, although that group was much more about cooperating with each other, which is very different from belonging to NATO, in which your forces are under joint command. But they've just decided that this is too dangerous at this point. And so the irony here, as you note, is Moscow went marching into Ukraine, arguing that a country that was its peaceful neighbor had posed too much of a security threat to it and saber-rattling over NATO. And now, in return, they're going to get another 830 miles of a border for Moscow to defend and also find themselves in a situation where the Nordic countries tightening their grips, or NATO has the potential to tighten its grip, for instance, on the Baltic Sea, which is Russia's access to St. Petersburg.
Finland, believe it or not, for a country of 5.5 million, actually has a pretty robust military. They're on the way to spending more than 2% of GDP on the military with the big purchase of F-35 military aircraft that NATO uses. And Sweden isn't at 2% yet, but they say that they will get there by increasing defense spending through 2028. And this, again, this increased defense spending is another way that the invasion of Ukraine has backfired on the Russians. And Kyle, the United States Senate will have to approve amendment to a treaty. NATO is a treaty passed with 2/3 vote, so it would have to be approved. I suspect this will move through the Senate in bipartisan fashion in fairly short order, although there should be a healthy discussion and debate about it.
Yeah, I would suspect it would too, and let's hope so. And one thing I would point out, as our colleague Adam O'Neill never fails to, is there's been some criticism of recent NATO accessions, for example, Montenegro, small countries like that. But Sweden and Finland are totally different animals. They have assets, they have strategic territory, islands in the Baltic Sea that would be useful. They already coordinate closely with other NATO allies. And so I would imagine that this makes more sense and they could be contributors to the NATO alliance. And so I would suspect this would go through the Senate pretty swiftly, which is the way this ought to be done. You know, if Finland and Sweden are going to join NATO, then let's make sure it gets done fast while Vladimir Putin has other things on his mind.
All right, Kyle. All right, Kim. Thank you so much. Thank you all for listening. Remember, you can email your satisfaction or dissatisfaction to us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. Please be sure to catch Jerry Baker's podcast, Free Expression, which is published on a Monday, and you can listen to it on your favorite podcast provider. You can catch Potomac Watch every day, and so we look forward to having you with us tomorrow on another edition of Potomac Watch.